Tonight I'm going to be talking about the spectrum of desire. By spectrum, what I mean is that desire is not just one experience, nor is it one experience that's more or less intense. But in the Dharma and, you know, in our lives, what we experience that we will refer to as desire is a lot of different experiences. In my email, I said that I would talk about the genesis and consequences of desire. I'm going to go to the genesis, and I'm going to try to help you see this. It bubbles up like water in a spring when we have any experience. When I touch something or smell or see, hear something, I have pretty much a human body, and pretty much the human body will respond to sensory input with three tones, three feeling tones, which we call vedana in Pali. Vedana is a much better word than feeling, which is the way it's usually translated. You really can't beat the Pali. That's V as in Victor, vedana. And again, it's that the body responds, body and mind respond with, I like it, I don't like it, or I'm neutral. So it's pleasure, displeasure, or indifference. It can be very difficult to see this, sort of like the first time. Like the first time that you see spaciousness in your mind. It's sort of like, oh, there it is, and now I can look for it. I think traditionally it's been taught, and this is the way I first encountered vedana, was in a retreat setting. Vedana is the second foundation of mindfulness. And I'm not really going to be teaching it that way tonight, but I think it's important to understand that the first foundation is the body. And that's pretty much what we do most of the time, is we bring the attention into the experience of the body and kind of use the sensations of breathing as the anchor of our mindfulness. Well, we can move on and use that mental clarity that we have from being mindful of the body to be mindful of the body interacting with the environment and to see the spring, the wellspring of desire. Why do we want to see that? Because we can have a good time or a bad time in this life depending on how we approach it, how we guide ourselves through the labyrinth of life. And if we are clinging to things as life is going along, as Joseph Goldstein likes to say, we're going to get rope burn. We're going to suffer because we kind of need to move along with life. We need some flexibility, and clinging, going against the flow, is a prescription for suffering. Doesn't mean that we have to join whatever is going on that, you know, we don't agree with. But we do need to recognize what is happening here and deal with that rather than what we wish was happening. I think there are easier ways to get in touch with vedana. And I'm going to try a little Dharma parlor trick with you tonight. And I brought, you may recognize this. This is an artifact from the 90s. It's called a boom box. So we're all set up. And if you're in the future and you've downloaded this and you're listening to it on your MP3, don't try this while you're driving, okay? Now, I invite you to relax. Kind of bring the attention inward as if you were meditating. And pay attention to the way the body feels. See if you can find a moment of relaxation. And you are going to hear something. And I want you to notice how the body feels at the moment you hear it. So being receptively relaxed. So, pleasure, displeasure, neutrality. And I'll just keep moving along. Pleasure, displeasure, neutral. Welcome back. So did anybody notice feeling pleasure, displeasure, or a neutral reaction? How about this one? Did you like that one?
No.
One of the greatest pieces of music ever written.
That's funny because I like it and I hear it as a symphony. It's Beethoven's Fifth. But I didn't like it in the context of being here.
So basically, there's an overlay of interpretation. Once we did any of you recognize it after you had that unpleasant response? And did your mind say, wait, I'm supposed to like this?
Yeah.
Okay, great. What about the baby? Did anybody hear the baby laugh?
Yeah.
Was there a difference in your Vedana to the adults laughing and then hearing the baby? Okay. And how did the mind deal with that? Did you identify it as a baby? Okay. Was it more pleasant? All right. Great. You got Vedana. Oh. It's a very somatic experience, Vedana is, and it's fast. Did you notice that? So I think I've gotten the point across that Vedana is this instantaneous response of the body that's pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. there's not much we can do about it in that initial moment, but right after that, the mind can get active and it can magnify the displeasure or the pleasure, or it can start spacing out with the neutral because it's just not very interesting. There are a couple of other places where we can observe Vedana. One is conversations. When you're listening to somebody talk, you may notice that they'll say things you like. And then they'll say things you don't like. And then they'll be really boring. And when you observe that, most likely you're observing Vedana as it's filtered through your past experience. When we interpret the sensory data, then the mind has created this filter of meaning. When we're just getting the raw sensory data, like something is dipped on the tongue and we taste it and it's honey, most of the time it's going to be an instant pleasant response. For some people, not so much. But when we think, oh, I wasn't going to eat any sugar this week, then it's an unpleasant response. Art exhibits. I find that I can really observe this Vedana response. But then, very quickly, I go into other aspects of the spectrum of desire because I will decide I'm going to keep on walking past this picture, or I'm going to stand in front of this picture until my friends get really tired of waiting for me. So I go beyond Vedana into the next phase, which I will talk about very soon. But before I leave Vedana, I want to point out that although it's this immediate, instinctive, physiological response we can't do anything about, there's still a problem with it because the body likes pleasure and it doesn't like displeasure, and there is this lean toward the pleasure, and it sets up the mind to believe that pleasure equals happiness. And the more pleasure I have in my life, the happier I am. And that's when we start to take the wrong path. Again, I just want to bring back to the point that our immediate experience of Vedana can be influenced by past experience, and in turn, it will influence our future experience. There is a very strong feedback loop involved with all of this. Actually, the paradigm that I'm using for this talk is in the 12 links of dependent origination, which I think Deb has been talking about recently, and you may be familiar with that topic. In these 12 links, we kind of keep going in this spiral. One thing leads to another, and then here we go around again, and it just keeps building. And in about 4 or 5 of these links, they have to do with desire, and we can see how this feedback keeps building up. When Vedana grows up, it becomes craving. Like an emotion, the word in Pali is tanha, which is probably better translated as thirst. It's like we're going to die if we don't get it. And these emotions are not just the desire that comes from liking, but also the aversion, which grows out of the displeasure, We don't want things that displease us. We don't want to be meditating and hear the first notes of Beethoven's Fifth. And with the neutral, we develop indifference. Craving, the way it's used can be a little awkward. It's the basket into which we dump the emotions of both the liking and the disliking. Although in common parlance, it means a fierce desire. And I tend to talk about it in that sense because that's what desire is. It's a desire for the pleasant. And when we have this desire, we start to engage in fantasies about getting it. Every evening at about 6:30, 7 o'clock, I have fantasies of chocolate. And then maybe I'll have a fantasy or two of, you know, not wanting to eat any more spinach or something that I've had enough of because I thought it was good for me and I don't want any more. But these pleasant fantasies, again, can build on themselves, and the object of the desire can become really idealized. Like, oh man, this is the world's best chocolate. I just scored it at Trader Joe's, and my friends turned me on to it, and they love it, and now I'm just as savvy as they are about really good chocolate. And the things that we don't like, we have fantasies disparaging them. For example, Brussels sprouts, don't get me started. Our cravings begin to warp the mind. We begin fixating our attention on what we want. And it kind of blurs the other things. We're not paying so much attention to them, or such good attention, so that we're not clearly seeing things as they are. Other thoughts come up and align themselves with the predominant desires so that we think other people should want this. People who don't want chocolate, what's that about? I it's inconceivable to me. Maybe peanut butter. You know, they're okay if they also like peanut butter. But if they don't like either, really, we have nothing in common. So, again, there's this feedback where craving influences the Vedana and will determine future cravings. Now, one of the problems with craving, other than the ones that I've mentioned, is that it's often confused with motivation, or even worse, it's confused with love. Oh, I just love that. I love chocolate. Craving, as opposed to motivation, is fueled by pleasant fantasies of pleasure. With motivation, we can desire things that are much more constructive than sensual pleasure. And this is what you see in the suttas, where it sounds like Buddha is really disapproving of pleasure or of desire. He's talking about living a life that's ruled by this very simple, primitive way of getting happy. You know, a life where our joy is based on eating candy, basically. When desires arise from wisdom, they can have a strength that's as strong as craving. For example, we can have a desire for safety, that the body is sheltered from the elements and fed well enough to remain healthy and have medicine when we need it. We can have a powerful desire for creative expression, for others' well-being, and a very powerful desire for the spiritual liberation of all being. So whether or not we desire constructive things depends on whether or not we're feeding unhealthy cravings. And the clearest example of this is addictions. It's so clear that we call a lot of things these days addictions that the medical profession is probably hesitant to call by that name. Or 50 years ago, no one would have called it an addiction. But today we recognize that if we're engaging in compulsive behavior for pretty simple sensual comfort or pleasure, it's not wise. We are under the grip of craving. Now, I mentioned not just is craving mistaken for motivation, but it can also be mistaken for love. And I would like to give you a rule of thumb to tell them apart, and that is the ideation that goes along with it. If we are thinking, person X will make me happy, so I really want person X in my life, that's desire. That's craving. If we really want person X to be happy, that's love. Okay? So if the juice, the power behind it is this belief that there's something in it for me that's pleasant, and I want all the pleasure I can get because pleasure equals happiness, then we have fallen into this pit trap that Buddha warns us about. Beware of sensual desire, because it won't really make you happy. If we indulge in craving, then it will grow up to become clinging. And clinging, Buddha said, is the source of all suffering. It's that holding on to things that are going to change. We indulge in behaviors like accumulating things, hoarding them, irrationally protecting them. Pleasure, this level of pleasure, can also extend to experience. You know, girls just want to have fun. Sports or vacations, things like that. Not that there's anything bad with them, but when they start to take over our lives, or we really begin to believe that that's the route to happiness, is a good vacation, then we've gone down the wrong path. In the extreme, this clinging, the behavior that it evokes or that it represents, it's going to take us to war, either as a nation or as individuals, where we're willing to hurt others to get or to avoid what we want or don't want. Usually, though, we use speech to maneuver, to bargain, to threaten, to get what we want. Clinging then grows up to be what's called in English becoming, or in Pali, bhava, a way of being or relating. In other words, habits. Clinging becomes a habit, and then that leads to what's called birth or jati, a rising of the self, or the idea of who I am. So this feedback loop I was talking about gets to the point where it's me. I am the person who eats chocolate every night because that's the most important thing, is that pleasure. So the problem isn't desire. The problem isn't pleasure or aversion or dislike. It's when we don't see any of this. And that's why I did this to you tonight. I'm sorry I put you in a vulnerable place, and then I played Beethoven into your ear. But I really wanted you to see Vedana, because it's where it starts. And it's harmless at that level, but it grows up. It grows up fast. Before you know it, I can remember on the retreat where I first saw Vedana, I would not take a dish at dinner because it had in it those vegetables that should never have been grown on planet Earth. And after I saw Vedana, I thought, oh, nuts on it, and took a bite, and it was delicious. And it wasn't until later that I realized I had very happily been eating lima beans for the first time since I was 5. The problem isn't desire, but letting it grow and take over the mind and the heart and our conduct and eventually become who we are, or at least who we think we are, because no matter how habit-bound we are, it's not really who we are. Thank you.